This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. We have been exploring water supply and water quality during our Project Milwaukee series, Great Lakes, Troubled Waters. Today, we turn the clock back 26 years.
Is Milwaukee's water safe or not? There is still no definite answer to that question, and there may not be until at least next week. Officials have pinpointed the cause of the flu so many have suffered locally, but determining where the troublesome organism...
That's Bob Bach speaking on WUWM in 1993. What was at first considered to be a widespread case of a terrible flu turned out to be cryptosporidium in our water supply, mainly at the Howard Avenue Water Treatment Plant on Milwaukee's south side.
Cryptosporidium is a type of parasite found in many water sources, lakes, rivers, streams, and even in soil. It causes gastrointestinal illness that can last for several weeks. The disease cryptosporidiosis can be very severe and even fatal, especially to young people, the elderly, pregnant women, and people with weakened or suppressed immune systems. In Milwaukee, 104 people died, more than 4,000 were hospitalized, and more than 400,000 people got sick.
Paul Biedritsky was manager of environmental health for the city of Milwaukee during the outbreak, and he thinks the lessons from 1993 are worth knowing. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski and begins by explaining the circumstances that led to the largest crypto outbreak in North America.
So I think the exact cause of the cryptosporidium outbreak is under still debate. It obviously involved a confluence of environmental influences that really created a challenge to our water treatment plants, both on the south end and we believe really on the north side as well. The confluence events included watershed events, meaning events to our river, high precipitation and snowmelt during that time of year, increased river flow, which might have meant, or we believe might have meant, increases in non-point pollution inputs. There were combined sewer overflows or diversions at our wastewater treatment plant. And then there were cross connections we examined within our own Menominee Valley involving tanneries and stockyards. And again, cryptosporidium reservoirs include cattle. So we looked at a number of different inputs to the watershed combined with weather events such as increased rainfall and snowmelt that really resulted in a large contaminated plume entering nearshore Lake Michigan and overshadowing at least one of our water treatment plants.
And this plume is because the water utility had to expel overflow of sewage, is that correct? Or how did the plume, what is the plume and how did it occur?
The plume really occurs at the confluence of the three rivers in our watershed, the Milwaukee River, Kinnikinick River, and Menominee River, and really occurs right around or near the Hone, underneath the Hone Bridge, and then empties out into the near shore area within the break wall and then outside the break wall as well. So this is a plume that's driven by river flow and velocity into, again, the confluence in the near shore area.
Okay. And with the location of where certain water intake is from the lake in the facilities, you know, how did that factor into it? And there's also something that was monitored called turbidity.
Turbidity
levels. So what is turbidity and how is it monitored and is it still a standard practice to monitor that?
So turbidity refers to how cloudy the water is, and it's a common metric in water treatment plant processes and is monitored real time by water treatment plants typically and gives some idea of whether or not there might be contamination. The water may be contaminated. It's cloudy. It also can be a measure of, again, how well disinfectants are working to oxidize contaminants in the water as well. So the reservoir for our drinking water here in the Milwaukee area is Lake Michigan, and the cribs or water intakes for either treatment plant are located offshore at that time in a fairly short distance offshore in a fairly shallow water. So that certainly played a role in the plume overshadowing and challenging the water treatment plants during that time period.
With cryptosporidium, is that something that's regularly tested in water treatment facilities at the time? Again, this is in the early 90s. Or did reports of diarrhea from the population and flu-like symptoms prompt further investigation?
So cryptosporidium, again, was an emerging pathogen and really not on our radar, especially in North American water treatment plant systems or reservoirs. This was considered a subtropical, tropical disease, and we knew very little about cryptosporidium here in the United States, much less its impact on drinking water through watershed contamination. So the Milwaukee Health Department became aware of massive amounts or high incidence of diarrheal illness in the community through complaints we receive from nursing homes, absenteeism rates at large employers here in the city of Milwaukee, and then complaints that we later learned were being received weeks earlier to the Milwaukee Water Works, or the water utility. So that gave us some idea that something was happening in the community. We weren't yet convinced it was waterborne in nature, but we knew that perhaps there was a large disease outbreak occurring. In retrospect, we now realize that complaints about odor, water color, and water taste were being made to the water utility weeks in advance, and that coincidentally, at the same time, there were modifications being made at least one of the treatment plants in terms of how they treated raw water intake. We refer to that as flocculation and sedimentation, and they were really piloting a new type of flocculant at the time. So really, the confluence of the plume occurring along with the testing of the new way of treating the water really played into, again, the massive exposure that we believe occurred in the metropolitan area during that time. But diarrheal illness wasn't detected early by any means within our community, as it would be now, given the advent of syndromic surveillance, looking for clues of disease incidence in the community prior to any clinical diagnosis, as well as the reporting of other types of signals in the community, like the use of antidiarrheals, absenteeism rates, and then incidence of illness in institutional settings like schools, daycares, or long-term care facilities.
Yeah, I imagine as a person involved in the city of Milwaukee health department that it's hard to anticipate or respond to things when you're relying on people to inform you about it compared to, as you mentioned, there's better surveillance and better accounting of, you know, citywide illnesses to try and anticipate the needs of a city. And here you're waiting for people to call and complain
exactly
to you. So was there a disconnect in communications between water utility and public health? I understand they're two separate city entities and departments, but at the time, was there no point of contact or protocol to be followed where, okay, if a certain amount of reports are filed, we then have to go to the city?
So clearly between public health and the water utility, and this isn't unusual anywhere across the United States, and I think in some ways is pervasive, this difference in cultures between water utility professionals and public health professionals. And certainly that played a role in impeding or inhibiting early warning and detection related to this outbreak. I think those cultures really deal with the comfort in information sharing on a routine basis, you know, not only information sharing, but the types of information that you might want to share between entities, and really the establishment of protocols or action thresholds and what consensually what actions should be taken should thresholds or triggers be tripped. So this cultural, again, difference is not unique to Milwaukee, still does exist. At the time, it was very disparate. You had the water utility as the primary provider of water, the only provider of water, actually, drinking water, high-quality product, per se. And most water utilities adopt a business model, which is, you know, a customer or client relationship with the water utility or provider, where the health department, the local health departments, tend to be more social scientists and deal with, you know, patients and clients that are experiencing maybe health issues or difficulties. And so our approaches are even different to dealing with our customers, so to speak. And again, that's neither good or bad, but did impede early warning and detection as related to this particular outbreak.
So going back to the timeline of events, you were receiving complaints or going out. When was the day that, or around the time that crypto was then confirmed? And then When was the city officially responding to that? John Nordquist was mayor at the time. So when was the point where it's like, okay, this was recognized and tested? And when did city officials make that public outreach effort to give out warnings and safety protocols?
So I remember this very clearly because it was kind of the Easter holiday weekend. April 7th was the official date in which a boil water advisory was declared by Mayor John Nordquist at the strong recommendation of then Health Commissioner Paul Nanus. A few days before, illness came to the attention of the Milwaukee Health Department, widespread illness in the community, through, again, a number of different signals that really we solicited for lack of a better word, we solicited nursing home or long-term care facility complaints about widespread diarrheal illness, absenteeism from very large employers in the city. And I also remember a specific case of the diagnosis and confirmation of cryptosporidiosis in a non-immunocompromised individual, which is a very rare occurrence because, again, cryptosporidiosis was considered back then an opportunistic infection to vulnerable individuals such as the immunocompromised. And to really diagnose cryptosporidiosis in a non-immunocompromised patient is pretty rare, especially in this geographic region. So I think the combination of those signals, along with some early conversations with the water utility about the amount of complaints they were receiving around odor, taste, and illness, really precipitated a very good decision in retrospect by then Mayor John Norquist to issue a boil water advisory.
What other public information was given and proactively shared by the city? Do you think they had a good use of public media in doing outreach after the outbreak was confirmed?
Well, this was very new territory for us. In retrospect, I think we did the best we could with the information we had. I think we, at the health department, recommended and pushed for a strong level of transparency by the mayor and other policymakers regarding the outbreak. And at that point, we suspected that water was implicated but weren't 100% certain. So risk communication was initiated under the agreement that it would be frequent, routine, transparent, and that we would do everything we could in terms of marshaling resources and collaboration within the community, which meant, you know, between federal, state, local government, as well as across the community, among private, nonprofit, and other government agencies to conduct a rapid assessment and institute what I would consider effective prevention intervention measures to mitigate the impact in our community. And again, it's important to know we had no idea of the scope and breadth of exposure or amount of illness at that time. It was in the following weeks that we realized this was of incredible magnitude, again, characterized as one of the largest cryptosporidiosis outbreaks in North America.
So I imagine besides the acute illnesses that were appearing throughout the city, what concerns did people have during this outbreak? You know, because obviously drinking water is a pretty standard reaction, like, okay, it's not safe to drink water necessarily. But what about water use such as showering, cleaning dishes, you know, all the other things we use water for? What kind of preventive measures or precautions were advised that people take? Because I imagine a lot of people had to change their habits.
Yeah, we were kind of caught off guard, even in our own thinking of how widespread water was being used in how many ways other than just drinking consumption. We're talking about the economic impact, how many manufacturers, industries, even within the supply chain were using water, potable water as part of their product, how it was used extensively in entertainment venues for sanitary purposes, whether it be toileting or washing your hands, how it was integrated within the community. I think we weren't fully aware of the spectrum of uses of water in our community, short of just drinking water consumption. So a lot of the recommendations were made on the fly at that time, given how little we knew about the trajectory of cryptosporidium in our community, like the level of illness, the infective dose, who was most vulnerable, and how exposure was occurring. What was the most important mode of transmission? So we made lots of decisions on risk communication that were on the fly based on best available information from our federal and state partners, as well as through literature, what was available. And again, that was very limited. This was considered a tropical.
Was it considered the first outbreak?
I think the first major? Absolutely. The first major outbreak involving a modern drinking water treatment system in North America. There were other outbreaks, I believe, associated, smaller outbreaks with recreational water use, swimming pools, lakes, rivers, but none of this magnitude, and especially the challenge to a modern drinking water treatment system. I think that was the most revealing. One of the takeaways I remember that was discussed was regulatory compliance and how a drinking water treatment system managed by a very, you know, competent water utility that was in full regulatory compliance could pose a public health threat. And one of the light bulbs that I know went off for me as well as my colleagues was that the current regulatory framework was not protective of public health if indeed they were in regulatory compliance and we had an outbreak, a waterborne outbreak of this magnitude.
Right. Now, you mentioned, you know, of this magnitude. So let's get into the specifics of community impact. What kind of numbers of people infected, sick, deaths occurred during this time?
So we estimate upwards to 403,000 individuals were adversely impacted, meaning became ill at some level associated with this outbreak. And the time frame of the outbreak is even a little speculative. We believe that exposure may have occurred weeks, maybe 2 to 3 weeks before actual detection and reaction by local public health officials. We did eventually record 68 deaths associated with this outbreak. That's a very large case fatality rate for, again, a North American city that utilizes a very modern water treatment plant system. Most of those deaths were among immunocompromised individuals, especially those in the HIV/AIDS community or population. So this had tremendous impact in terms of community morbidity and mortality. It also had a tremendous impact on consumer confidence regarding water systems that unfortunately still carries on today even.
Right. I was just about to ask how it affected consumer confidence because I imagine a lot of people who have lived through this probably still distrust water utility or city health and those types of organizations, you know?
They do. And we've had many discussions with the legislators, the mayor's office, the water utility regarding improving consumer confidence. But people who have lived through that type of event are very slow to change behavior after you've experienced that level of illness. In addition, the Milwaukee Health Department put together a brochure for immunocompromised individuals because even to this day, we cannot guarantee, given the infective dose of cryptosporidium might be as low as 1 U-cyst, that people severely immunosuppressed may not become ill or infected from drinking City of Milwaukee water. We know that we've made very significant improvements to our water treatment plant and distribution process. We've improved monitoring and surveillance of the drinking water and of disease in our community remarkably, but we still have not totally with 100% certainty eliminated that risk. So we do urge individuals after consultation with their healthcare provider to drink bottled water from a known cryptosporidium-free source, water that has been filtered using an absolute 1 micron or less filtration system, or water that has been boiled.
We know that water gets treated before it comes out of our faucets, but probably not how. Since this outbreak occurred, is there a greater effort of open communication between Waterworks and the city and the public to show and give a greater understanding of this is what happens to our water before it comes to you?
Yeah, I think there have been many, many improvements, although I would caution that remark by saying it isn't yet optimal. But there have been many improvements by the water utility and local public health to provide outreach, especially to vulnerable populations, to healthcare providers, working with environmental and community groups to build awareness, not only about water quality, but about the importance of water resource stewardship and conservation, to educate individuals about the value of water as an asset, especially in the city of Milwaukee that characterizes itself as a modern 21st century water city. So there's been many improvements, including information sharing between water utility and local public health that I think is very beneficial. However, 25 years later, I still see evidence that we're beginning to regress back to our silos as the outbreak starts fading in our memories or fading institutionally within the city as a bureaucracy. And I think that's a vulnerability within our community that we need to be very aware, not only because of cryptosporidium, but there are many emerging threats, microbial, chemical, climate change, aging infrastructure, and lack of investment in infrastructure that's creating the perfect storm for the next major waterborne contamination event.
You mentioned aging infrastructure. At the time after the outbreak was, quote, dealt with or at least passed, $90 million was spent on a new water purification system. So what did this new system do that the old one wasn't capable of doing? And where did the funding come from? Because this was a public health crisis. So is there special funding that was allocated either by the federal or state government to respond to this and to give this new water for purification system, to get that installed?
Yeah. So I can talk about the improvements to the water treatment plant, and I'm a little fuzzy on where the money came from. I believe it was requested and approved by the Milwaukee Common Council at the encouragement of the mayor. So I think the funding was found in the city budget. Some of it might have been supplemented by federal and state funding, but I'm pretty sure the money came from the city budget. Whether it was emergency funding, capital improvement funding, it came from the city coffers at the request of the mayor and the approval of the Common Council. And that $90 million went to upgrades to both treatment plants in a number of different areas. One was to extend the water intakes to deeper water and farther out in the lake so it would not be vulnerable to these contamination plumes that are really yearly or annual occurrences. It's a function of having three heavily urbanized rivers meet right at the near shore area here in Milwaukee. And those urban watersheds are influenced by runoff as far up as Fond du Lac County, where the headwaters of the Milwaukee River are located. So they're subject to a lot of influences within the metropolitan area as well as outside the metropolitan area. So moving those intakes, I think, alleviated some of the vulnerability associated with being overshadowed by these contamination plume events that inevitably occur each year as a function of our geography and the watershed, nature of the watershed.
Because during the time it was the Howard Avenue treatment plant that had the highest concentration?
It was at the time identified at the Howard Avenue, given the predominantly southern flow of the lake currents during that time of year. So the confluence of the rivers meet around the Hone Bridge and then typically overshadow the harbor and near shore area and flow southerly. So that would impact predominantly, but not exclusively, the Howard Water Treatment Plant.
So this $90 million towards new water purification systems was not just for Howard Avenue. It was for all
water
treatment?
It was for both water treatment plants. It only made sense because, again, there was a lot of uncertainty on how vulnerable the other plant would be. And we didn't want to, again, we wanted to make sure that we were being very comprehensive in our approach, or the city was being comprehensive in its approach. Another very important upgrade was the use of ozone as a disinfectant. And at that time, research indicated that ozonation, unlike chlorination, which is a very common disinfectant used in water treatment plant systems, was effective in inactivating oocysts, Cryptosporidium and Giardia oocysts in water treatment plant. That research, again, has been now clarified in terms of water temperature and certain environmental conditions in which ozone is more optimally effective. So while ozone is an improvement, it is not by any means the silver bullet. But ozonation was installed not to replace chlorine, but to supplement chlorination of our drinking water. And then changes were made to the filtration system, moving from sand filtration to an artificial media that is far more effective in discriminating for cysts like Cryptosporidium or those that are similar within Giardia. So the movement of the water intakes, the change in filter media from sand to an artificial media, and then the implementation of ozonation were all used in conjunction with other improved surveillance methods by the water utility and the local health department to improve early warning detection and mitigate, again, the potential for a future outbreak associated with a protozoan or parasite like Cryptosporidium.
So on top of the obvious addressing problems with water purification and the filtration system once it gets treated, what were other key lessons learned from discovering and responding to this outbreak? Because as you said, it was the first of its kind, and the City of Milwaukee Health Department was responding in real time. There was no precedent set by a different city in North America in ways to address this. So what new, say, protocols are in place after such a big event of this magnitude, a public health crisis?
I think one of the most important was, and again, it was ordinance defined and really demanded by the mayor's office, was close collaboration between the water utility and the Milwaukee Health Department around everything water quality. And so that resulted in interagency work groups, both technical and community engaging, to be formed to really establish a water preparedness plan And I think that was incredibly important. Part of that was to share information routinely, not, you know, in the heat of battle, but to share information ahead of time and routinely regarding water treatment plant metrics and parameters and disease incidence and occurrence in the community. Secondly, developing triggers or thresholds for action where we would need to consider, again, boil water advisories or discontinuation of treatment plant operations or the use of public messaging, risk messaging, during various environmental or disease incidence events. I think that was incredibly important as well. The implementation of early detection and warning systems, too, where we could monitor near real time turbidity and particles within the water was implemented at both treatment plants, as well as syndromic surveillance systems that looked at the sale of over-the-counter drugs, for example, within the community as well. And even though, again, they add to the veracity of the overall system, neither are silver bullets in and of themselves. This is more about people, the collaboration, the melding of cultures between the water utility and public health that makes the system work. And then there was this idea of community resilience. How do we engage the whole of community to build a more resilient community around waterborne contamination events, including making the public aware of where our water is derived, how it is treated, how it is supplied, how to get information regarding the quality of water, and then how to access alternative water supplies in the event of a boil water advisory or a discontinuation of potable water within the city. And sustaining that effort, again, during a widespread contamination event like Cryptosporidium was extremely challenging. We knew that every day the water treatment plant was down created, you know, a significant social and economic impact for our community, as well as a health impact. So I think connecting the dots between health, the economy, and social fabric really was incredibly important. And again, I think those threads have been connected. I don't think they're optimally reinforced even today, given how the Cryptosporidium outbreak is becoming a distant memory for many of us.
Yeah, you mentioned there are no silver bullets to ensure that something like this doesn't happen again or that, you know, some new type of water threat can occur for us. How would you recommend that this communication stays open and is reinforced so that it's not just a matter of responding to another public health crisis? Yeah.
So I really think it's incumbent upon the whole of community. And by that, I mean policymakers in government, the private sector, nonprofits, environmental groups, really to step to the plate, play collaboratively, build consensus on a strategic direction that includes investment within water resources. One of the greatest threats, as we mentioned, to drinking water in this country is aging infrastructure. And I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. So making an investment in water resources now instead of during an outbreak or contamination event only makes sense. And the people in the best position to do that are policymakers, the private sector that benefits from potable water supplies, environmental groups that have skin in the game regarding stewardship and conservation, and then the general public, again, who I think remains vulnerable to drinking water quality threats in whatever form they take.
Paul Biadritsky was the manager of environmental health for the city of Milwaukee during the Cryptosporidium outbreak of 1993. You can see more extended coverage from our Project Milwaukee series at WUWM.com.